This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to Pressing Matters, the show where we go behind the headlines and explore issues driving the press. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. Now, it's important to celebrate progress in women's rights in Malaysia, and there were two important legislative wins last week. Parliament passed the Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill, which was decades in the making, and the Kedah State Assembly raised the minimum age for Muslim marriages to 18 years old. But even as we welcome these developments, the case of a Malaysian-born mother who was detained along with her three children by immigration authorities and is at risk of deportation highlight the glaring inequalities that women face in getting legal recognition as citizens. So with me today for a roundup of all these stories and how they impact women's rights in Malaysia is Tamina Kausji, independent journalist and gender equality activist. Tamina, thanks for joining me in studio today.
Thank you so much, Shazana. I think it's a great time to, you know, have a quick roundup of what's been happening over the past 2 weeks. Parliament is still in session. Pretty exciting times.
Exciting times indeed. So let's start with the Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill, which is arguably a landmark piece of legislation that's been a long time coming. As a gender equality activist, do you think it provides a sufficient framework to address sexual harassment in the country?
Right. So first and foremost, I definitely want to acknowledge, you know, the relentless efforts of women's groups, rights advocates, and also, of course, the cooperation and collaboration of governments of the day ever since 2018 when the bill was first tabled. All of that is wonderful, and none of this would have happened without this. But at the same time, I think it's really important to zoom in and focus on whether or not this bill in its current iteration, is it survivor-centric? And also, what about the organizational duties to ensure that workplace sexual harassment does not actually occur, together with who's monitoring everything? So these are some of the main core issues that come up once again. And I think already women's groups and their representatives have raised these issues. And they have spoken about the fact that ultimately one of the main arenas in which not just women, but of course also men are exposed to sexual harassment is at the workplace. Without organizational duties, you know, hard coded into the language of the bill, it just removes the opportunity for transformational change and workplace cultures to also match up with global standards for anti-sexual harassment and also for respectful cultures at the workplace.
So just to clarify, the law as it stands at the moment doesn't actually place any obligation on employers to have these standards or guidelines, right? It's more of a voluntary thing, or it's good for them to do it, but there are no legal obligations for to carry that out.
That's right. And once again, I think it draws back to us needing to remember that the MEF, or the Malaysian Employers Federation, they were absolutely against even seeing the need for having an anti-SH bill. So that could perhaps, you know, give us a little bit of a clue as to why it hasn't actually been included.
I wanted to bring that up because you did write an article last year calling out employer groups for viewing sexual harassment as isolated incidents in the workplace. And, you know, we can also couple that with the somewhat embarrassing display of machismo by Pasir Salat MP Datuk Tajuddin Abdul Rahman during the tabling of the bill and the comments that were made.
Absolutely.
I mean, does this point towards a larger mountain that needs to be conquered in order to actually implement the law, which is namely, I don't know, sexist perceptions of society, perhaps?
Yes, it's not just an I don't know, but you hit the nail smack on the head. I mean, it is about the fact that it's not just Malaysia, it's globally. I think we all are raised within parochial patriarchal structures whereby sexisms, gender stereotypes, minimization of, you know, survivors and victims is something which is just an automatic response almost. So what we see on display in Parliament via MP Pasir Salat and many others who also, let's not forget, back in 2016, referred to YB Teresa Kok as the only Kok in Parliament and was absolutely unapologetic about it. And in fact, actually pointed out that women from his party were in full support of it. So that was in 2016. But once again, it points to the fact that unless there are consequences to be paid for such actions, particularly in the August House itself, whereby the Speaker, Deputy Speaker, move beyond just even just warnings, perhaps a suspension is definitely in order, right? So if it didn't happen in 2016, it is something which becomes even more deeply entrenched, and you still see it in 2022. Right. No surprises there, but the fact that once again, no consequences are paid by offending individuals, all the way from those in positions like MPs to those in, you know, corporate arenas to everyday sexual harassment that women as well as other individuals may be facing on the street. Mm. It boils down to a bigger circle.
Right. And to bring that, I guess, discussion to the discussions that we have every day, right? And especially on social media, the way I see it, it's really easy to get discouraged by the barrage of social media commentary invalidating experiences of sexual harassment that women and people face. So from your observations, what has actually worked to encourage constructive discourse on this issue that's respectful of all the parties involved, yeah?
Right. I think there is an incredible amount of movement, particularly amongst mostly the newer women's and rights advocacy groups, as well as even a teenager like Ayn Husniza. Mm. Still a child, by all technical, classifications. But at the same time, due to her experiences, she has actually been able to sort of process what happened and actually become an advocate for respectful as well as, accurate interactions. And I think this points to a wider circle of, thought processes that are happening at all levels of society, particularly amongst children. Mm. So I think once you have the language for it, it becomes so much more powerful because in turn, sometimes it happens that the parents are the ones who are sensitized and sometimes it happens that the children are the ones who play a part in influencing their parents.
Right, like they raise it to their attention and say, hey, maybe we should be talking about it in this way. That's interesting, the fact that it's actually coming from the younger generation hoping to make a change in how we talk about things. Let's move on to the next story on our radar. And this is of Kedah. Kedah has officially joined Selangor in legislating the minimum age of marriage for Muslims to 18 years old. I don't know about you, but I know that I was surprised that this development came out of Kedah, from Kedah of all places.
Mm-hmm. That's right, exactly. And it was quite interesting because I was having this conversation with various friends as well as colleagues, even in the media industry. And I sort of posited to, I think, several of them on different occasions that perhaps it has to do with the fact that, even if it is supposedly a state with a conservative political majority, at the same time, it points to the fact that we must look at the life cycle of underage marriage, particularly when it comes to girls. What that generally creates is girls and eventually women who are dependent upon the state's welfare system due to the fact that underage marriages are generally not stable. It may or may not involve several planned or unplanned pregnancies. And in case there is a divorce and that actually results in a young woman or a young girl still in some cases who has had very bare minimum access to education and, of course, career as well as work and employment opportunities. Mm. That perhaps might be one of the reasons behind why a state like even Kedah has gone ahead with this.
That is such an interesting point to make because I feel that sometimes the conversation doesn't go far enough to look at the economic impact of underage marriages. It's a lot about usually, those in support cite morality as the reason for allowing teenagers to marry. But the harm it can cause goes beyond just the individual, beyond just the community, but it really affects the progress of the state and nation overall.
Absolutely, it does, right? I mean, if you want to look at Malaysia's 2030 SDG aspirations, you want to look at even the fact that we're still in the throes of a global pandemic and moving towards whatever the new normal may or may not be. Let's think about who falls between the cracks. It is not specifically teenage or underage marriage, but let's think of the fact that very recently we had the case of the 14-year-old who became pregnant and of course was then also charged for the murder of a newborn, which actually came through lack of access to digital devices during PDPR, right? Mm. So you have those kinds of marginalization that also tie in with sometimes the outcome actually being underage marriage for girls. So we can just look at what the life cycle ends to. And there have also been several landmark cases, particularly over the past 2 years, whereby you have such as the case of Hairun Jalmani, a woman in her 50s, yes, but also a single mother of several children, 9 or 10. At last count. Mm. And that also points to the fact that her life cycle began most likely, looking at the timeline, as a young woman or a girl who had unplanned and underage pregnancies. Mm. Mm. So it's a much, much, much wider cycle. We lack a lot of statistical data, etc., to draw hard conclusions. But at the same time, all of this needs to be looked into extremely deeply, particularly considering the economic vulnerability and further marginalization of already so-called B40, then you've also got indigenous groups and also those who may be stateless or even partly stateless.
I'm speaking to Tamina Kausji, independent broadcast journalist and gender equality activist, on recent headlines related to women's rights in Malaysia. We'll have more on this conversation when we come back in just a moment. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Thanks for staying tuned to Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. I'm Shazana Mokhtar, and with me today is Tamina Kausji, independent journalist and gender equality activist. We're rounding up some of the headlines related to women's rights in the past few weeks, and earlier we were talking about the Kedah state legislation that has raised the minimum age for Muslim marriages to 18 years old. Tamina, you were talking about some of the cases that stemmed from that issue, and it really just covers a wide spectrum of areas, really. I guess, given that there's so many factors that precipitate underage marriage and also the consequences of it, right? If we look at policy measures and how we should address this, what do you think the top policy priorities should be to tackle this issue?
I feel definitely the most important one is to note is that Muslim girls, though below the age of 18, can still be wed off, even in Kedah.
There's still a loophole.
Right? So that is the loophole. The loophole is, of course, that, you know, provided that they get the Sharia courts okay. And this, of course, can be enacted by the fact that even in Malaysia's civil law, it also allows girls between ages of 16 to 18 to marry as long as you've got the chief minister's approval. So these are gaping loopholes. And, you know, it is extremely important because at the same time, there has not been much movement about addressing all the other anchoring issues which result in underage marriage, such as economic deprivation and also perhaps in some instances and particularly in, let's say, perhaps East Malaysia, Sabah and Sarawak. You've also got cultural leanings as well. It is not always only the so-called Romeo-Juliet unions per
That's
se,
the romanticization
right?
of exactly, it all.
Exactly, exactly. And you can always see, you know, the crush of opposing forces as well, because this absolutely brings to mind the fact that I think just about a week ago, a video went viral of a school teacher pretty much instructing students, they appeared to be a group of 11, 12-year-old boys, on how to actually wear a condom, but using it on a, like it was actually like an example, right? It was not a physical body of a person or an individual. And that was lauded on one side by people on social media who said that, okay, this is wonderful that children are actually learning in a practical way and before they, in a sense, get into trouble, quote unquote. But at the same time, I think just a day or two ago, a faith-based group actually raised its ire against such practices. But at the same time, once again, a lot of underage marriages stem from the fact that there has actually been uninformed sexual activity between those of the Romeo-Juliet unions. So it's about removing that vulnerabilization. So if everything is a no-go, then what is a go, right?
Yep.
Yes, you have some states who are becoming a little bit more sensitized, and hopefully one by one, everything falls until federal has absolutely no ability to actually oppose in the way in which it did, and which is what DPM at that point in time, those Rewan Aziza actually mentioned, federal cannot because these states actually oppose.
Right.
Yes. So everything has to happen quite organically. And if it is not, it has to be pushed from all sectors so that it once again comes to one solid path at the end of the day.
Right, right. Okay. So in a way, we still do have a long way to go to actually completely abolish underage marriages in Malaysia.
Yes, we do.
But I guess every single step forward is something to be hopeful and to be optimistic about. And I think what happens in Kedah is a good example of that, that even, like you said, a conservative state like Kedah could make such a significant decision. Why not elsewhere? And hopefully we'll see more progress on that. Now, I want to turn our attention to another story. And this is a bit of a bittersweet story to cap our conversation today on. Let's talk about the case of the Malaysian-born mother of three young boys, all of whom were detained by the Immigration Department last week for purportedly not having proper documentation. I mean, it boggles the mind to me, really, that all these Malaysian-born people don't have documents. I mean, do we even know why this family doesn't have documents, even though they're born here?
Yeah, great questions. And you know what? And because we're talking about this topic, let's talk about the fact that the hashtag Keluarga Malaysia is all over the place. And the fact that you can absolutely hit back by asking, how is this Keluarga Malaysia? This is a family, a Malaysian family. And in fact, regardless of them not having their paperwork in order, they are all born in Malaysia, including the mother herself. It just defies logic. one has absolutely no explanation to be able to frame and encapsulate why this must be happening, right? Because on the flip side of it, you also, of course, have Malaysian women and their struggles with unequal citizenship. And this is for children who are foreign born. It is already bad enough to consider, in that sense, the fruit of a Malaysian mother's womb, not to be able to have Malaysian citizenship. But this absolutely boggles the mind.
I mean, there are a lot
They're still in detention, too.
I mean, a lot of questions there. And admittedly, we maybe don't know the full details of the case. But the fact is that it is quite distressing to see a mother and her children who have spent their entire lives in Malaysia now at risk of being deported to a country that they've never been to, that they didn't know.
That's right.
Just because of something that I don't know what kinds of flaws in the system there were that led to this situation. But to draw parallels with what you said about citizenship law and how mothers who give birth overseas aren't allowed to pass on citizenship to their children there. I mean, in the end, it creates this entire generation or this entire community of people who are stateless, right? Which in the end cause more issues for the country and for Malaysia than if it hadn't.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we are now all eagerly anticipating and looking forward to what the decision will be on August the 5th. It has been deferred to then. It was supposed to have been in late June, July. But now when we look at it, we're just wondering about what possibly could be, let's say, if the ruling does not turn out in favor of the Family Frontiers group, what could possibly the explanation be? Should we just ensure that now it actually goes to a vote from between the 222 MPs and we actually see whether or not how many of them are in support of Malaysian women's full humanity, not just gender equality, right? Because, of course, the argument that has been raised by the AGC alludes to the fact that the High Court ought not to have the ability to interpret the federal constitution.
Which... it boggles the mind a little bit. I'm not sure. I can't.
Well, of course, naturally, it has to go to the High Court first, right? Before it reaches the federal, right? That is a natural course of the law. However, I think it brings up a very interesting opportunity for this actually be taken to a vote in Parliament. And let's see how we move from there on.
I think that would be fascinating, right? Like, why not? Why not bring this matter to Parliament if...
Let's settle it once and for all, you know, rather than having to rely on, in a sense, a case-by-case basis.
Whether the government or really whether anybody would be able to bring that motion forward is another matter. That reflects
of
also
processes, yes.
Parliamentary processes and whether we're using them most effectively. But I do agree that if this case were to fail at the courts, at the court case as it's ongoing now, then Parliament and lawmakers really should step in to rectify this. I wonder, Tamina, maybe you can talk a little bit also about how does being stateless affect a person's life trajectory? Yeah, because I think a lot of us just take for granted that we have a Malaysian citizenship and that we have access to all the facilities. But given that there is a large stateless community in the country, how does this affect what happens to them and how far they can go in life?
Absolutely. Well, I can draw a little bit from my own experiences of having been in a very vulnerable position because of the fact that I am actually the adult child and overseas born of a Malaysian mother with a non-Malaysian father. So this actually led to various marginalizations over the course of my life, particularly when we migrated to Malaysia when I was just 10 years old. So comparatively, what it leads to is if you have a complete lack of access, vulnerabilities for education, for healthcare, for, of course, further education opportunities, employment opportunities, cars, housing loans, you know. So all these little factors that make up how an individual not just sees themselves, but also fits into a society. And of course, in the wider picture, is able to contribute back to society. Now, in that sense, I always feel this sting when I refer to myself as having been extremely privileged because it was extremely hard for even my family, even though we do come from a background that is not necessarily something which is below the B40. But there were many points in time that we were teetering on the edge. financially in particular, because also with regards to citizenship in particular, it generally comes with a wider scope of all financial responsibilities falling on the Malaysian parent, the mother, because the non-Malaysian parent, in this case is the father, is not able to economically contribute because you cannot even build a career for yourself there. So all of these come together, and just imagine the fact that there are also tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of children with even both parents who may be stateless, who are living in Malaysia, who could actually have been born in Malaysia itself. It's time for this to end. If we want to look at the big picture of Malaysia's not just economic recovery, but building a society where everyone who lives here can have a feeling of not just belonging, but allegiance and togetherness.
Right. If, as you said earlier, if they're really serious about building a keluarga Malaysia, then this really needs to be taken into account. I'm wondering, Tamina, how do these cases undermine Malaysia's attempt to present itself on an international stage as a champion of human rights and women's rights? Yeah, I can't help but think that when people read these headlines about how Malaysian women aren't allowed to confer citizenship, it undermines other genuine efforts by Malaysian authorities to do right by women.
Yes, absolutely. And you genuinely also feel for the diplomats who are working at the highest levels and putting in all the work that has led to some recognition for Malaysia, like in the Human Rights Council, etc. But of course, it has to be harmonious. You cannot be, tooting a certain horn in this arena and then doing the same opposite on the other, because statistics will show you otherwise. Of course, we have the latest ones about women's migration rates. Malaysian women, 57%, which is a straight 10% higher than most women in other neighboring countries such as Thailand, etc. Of course, in-depth research and data collation has not been done about what may be the specific reasons driving so very many Malaysian women to actually go abroad and overseas. But we've been discussing various factors which lead to women having a feeling of being othered in Malaysia.
Right. And if they're talking about brain drain and losing talent, I think this is just one avenue that's very clearly something that policymakers need to look at. Tamina, thank you very much for joining me today and for helping me round up all these really important stories.
Yeah, pleasure as always, Shoshana. Thank you.
I've been speaking to Tamina Kousgi, independent journalist and gender equality activist. This has been Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. Coming up next, we have the 10 a.m. news bulletin, and then it's over to Enterprise. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.